It works. Okay. So you wanted to have a review of the Cantor's matrix. So the the idea here is to say when you have two points in a Euclidean space, then the distance is a natural notion, right? It's what whoever can say that. Now, when you are in functional spaces, that things is trickier, right? So you got to define what it means to have a distance between waveforms, right? And so there are all kinds of ways you can do. So for example, there's a max norm, actually, but from a norm you can derive a distance that says that, for example, the matrix in this case will be the maximum of the difference between the two waveforms. So if you have the two waveforms that are f of t, now one and g of t, the other one, then you look at the time t where the two are maximally distant, and then you call that a matrix, right? So that's L infinity matrix, right? So it's yet another matrix is to take the integral of the two functions and then use that as a measure. So in other words, you take the integral of the difference, and that integral of the difference, of course, is zero. There is no difference between the two functions, but otherwise you have, again, the distance between the two functions. Now, there is also this norm here that is actually in continuous space. It's called the exponential norm that is considering the time where the time or the tag, whatever we can use the two interchangeably. So when the two waveforms differ, right? So this is particularly important when we have these iterations, right? Like 6-point iteration, where you build this waveform piece by piece, right? And so every time you go around the loop and you compute another iteration of the 6-point, the functions that you had before and function you have later kind of tends to coincide for a longer period of time. And every time you iterate, this is not destroyed, so another piece is added to what you are computing. So that then people said, okay, in order to measure how well we progress along this process of getting the waveform right by t, we define as the distance between the two functions e to the power t, where t is the time when the two waveforms differ. Right? It's the first time when the two waveforms differ. And so as t goes to infinity, of course, that goes to zero. Right? Actually, 1 over e, of course. Otherwise, it doesn't go to zero. Right? And that is the way in which you do it in continuous time. Now, the Cantor's matrix is using a similar concept, except now we are in discrete time. And that's the reason why you get the 2, 1 over 2, right, instead of having e. Right? And so this is the notion of the distance between two functions. Then if I give you this one function, I suppose, and this another function. Oops, assuming this doesn't work. So let's hope that there is another color that I can use. Ah, anyway. So what will be the value of the distance between the two factors? So they are equal up to here and then they differ. So this is the time, so it's time t, whoops. So, and this is in continuous time, but then the value is 1 over 2 to the power t, and where t is this t. A convex goes into. Okay. So now, if at the next iteration we have two waveforms, so the waveform is time t1 is what we computed is here, and then the next function is something like this, then what is the difference between these two functions? Yes, you get this time t, t double bath, damnation, t double bath, and then this is the distance between these two functions, t to the power t double bath. So, is the distance here larger or smaller than this? It's larger, right? Because time t is larger, so since it's 1 to 2 to the power t, that's, so which means that these two functions coincide for a longer period of time. That's all there is. And again, this was motivated by the six-point iteration in functional spaces. Okay, so the introduction of this norm. And in fact, it is the norm that is used, as I was telling you, to prove the theorem of existence and uniqueness of the solution of a differential equation. Because that is shown to indeed that every time you compute a particular iteration, that if you remember is x of t equal to integral of f of t plus zero, then if you put a particular function x t into this this formulation, then you see that you get a sequence of functions that are coinciding for longer and longer time. So suppose that I give you another two functions. So this one is like this again, and this one is like this. So what is the matrix here?
The first time
they differ. So it's this one. So even if intuitively it looks like these two are more similar than this, actually, and then this is actually, this one is a smaller distance because the time where they differ occurs earlier, right? And again, because we are interested in this movement of the convergence, okay? So that's the the Cantor matrix idea, okay? And so the causality that we say is that if the distance between f of s and f of s prime is less or equal than the distance between s and s prime, then we say that the process f of s is causal. Because in fact, you cannot get, what happens there is the fact that the input signal is causing the behavior of f of s and f of s prime. The strict causality is when the inequality is strict instead of being equally strict inequality. And then the delta causality is when the distance between these two is less or equal than a factor k of the distance between s and s prime. Okay? And so, again, if you imagine this process here, what you do is that you put the function back into here and you iterate there. And you see that if indeed you have a delta causal process, you are converging. And so this iteration will give you the correct behavior. In fact, this one is called, when this is true, this is a contraction mapping, which is the same as in continuous space. Right? So now, these notions have been obtained by the continuous space, transported into the discrete space. Now, okay, suppose that you want to compose two parallel processes. And two parallel processes, essentially, you get a number of inputs, of course, of the system, and then you get the outputs, and there is no connection between this and this. So obviously, if this process is causal, and this process is causal, then the composition, the parallel composition of it is causal. And if they are delta causal static or whatever. So the property of the combination is the same as the property of the two parts. And this is absolutely trivial, right? Because there is no connection. So, of course, the behavior of the overall system is equal to the behavior of the two parts. Now, suppose that you have a cascade composition, right? So now, this guy is connected to this. And now you want to say what happens to the two overall system. This is not going to be that much different, because if this one is causal strictly causal delta causal, what happens is that if this input is coming from this guy, then externally, if we take this away, this and this input comes from out of the system itself, this is still strictly causal delta causal whatever, right? the same thing happens to this, and so the composition of the two, again, if you have these two, which are causal, strictly causal, delta causal, then the same is true of the composition. Okay? So nothing changes. If you have a cascade composition, of course, the only thing that you do is you're essentially forcing one of the inputs of this process to be the output of this guy. So if anything, the range of the inputs is smaller in this case than the original case. So this is even better, if you like. So it certainly works. Okay. Now the source composition is interesting because F1 doesn't have any input. So it just produces output. So that's the reason why it's called a source. Right? Now if you compose the two, now this one doesn't make any sense to talk about strictly from delta causal whatever because there is no input. So the notion of this composition of the two blocks to be strictly delta causal and so on, the only thing that we need to assert is that this process here is determinate, which means that it can produce, that there is only one behavior or no behavior that F1 can have. Right? So if F1 is only one behavior, then F2 again is we know to be causal and da 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 da, and then this one doesn't change its property, and this guy here is a source output, and so this one is determinate, then we can conclude that the overall system is strictly delta causal if F2 has the same property. Now, this is the most interesting situation. That's where the problems arise, and we have to be careful. So at this point, we have F2, which is connected as a feedback loop. Right? So we take the output of the function, and we stick it back into the input. Now, the question is that, can we say that this composition here is has the same property as F1 and F2? Okay. Now, we will need some work. So the first thing that we do is that we cut the feedback loop, right, in some sense. So we consider an internal system here, and then we have this feed F which comes in from the output of F1. So let's take this view. So now, if F1 and F3 are determinate, and F2 is causal, strictly causal or delta causal, then the function f here, that is from F2 to F2, will be causal, strictly causal or delta causal respectively. Okay? So this thing that comes back here, cut in this position, has the properties that we make. But that's not quite enough, because now we have to determine what is the semantics of that feedback loop that we have shown there. So now, the meaning of having the output equal to the input is kind of funny, because you have a circular relationship. So you have x equal to f of x, right? Because if the input is x, right, then you have f of x, which is the output, and then the output has to be equal to the input, because they are connected together. So essentially, the equation that describes the behavior of that thing is x equal to f of x. Now, and so for that reason, that loop that is indicated there is said to have the semantics of a fixed point, which is what we just say, f of x equal to x. So the behaviors of this process here are all the f which satisfy this equation. Now, so let's look at the fixed point theorem as applied to discrete event systems. So now, notice that in the continuous space, the fixed point theorems are the basic of almost anything, right? Even in topology and the like. So it's really very foundational in a sense. And it is, you have some fantastic theorems about the existence of such fixed points. Because then the question to be asked is that, if I connect this in feedback, do I get anything out of this system or not? Right? Do I have a solution or not? because it may be such that, and we know that sometimes if you connect things in feedback loop, they may explode, right? So, and what does it mean they explode? That there is no solution to x equal to f of x. And so the system tries to find that and cannot find it, and then at some point it has to go bananas, right? Or what you can also observe in reality is that you observe oscillatory behavior. So that's what, and we know that that's no good, right? So in one case, it explodes, means it is not stable, right? And if it is oscillates, it is still not stable, but it's bounded, right? Because essentially, if you look at a dynamical system, it's equivalent to saying if you have the two, if you have two eigenvalues that are on the imaginary axis, right? When you have oscillates, okay. And so you cannot say that it's that the thing is stable, right? So, okay. Now, there is a very interesting fixed point theorem which is due to Brewer. It is a fundamental fixed point theorem that says a very important thing. So, if you have a mapping of the unit circle into itself, right? Then you know that that mapping has to have a fixed point. I mean, less assumptions than that, I cannot possibly figure out. And it's a fantastic, as I said before, fantastic theorem. So what can we do in the case of a discrete space and the like? So this is what we could say. So if F is strictly causal, then it has at most one fixed point. And this we should know because, again, we did as an example the fact that if you have a strictly causal system, then what happens is that the distance between S and S prime is larger than the distance between F of S and F of S prime. So if you put as S and S prime the results of the first iteration, you put in the second iteration, then the distance between the two iterations has to be smaller than what you started from. And so which means that eventually you're going to converge. Okay. So that's nice. So the feedback composition is determined if you have this strict causality, causal behavior. Now then there is the Banach fixed point theorem, and this one is a continuous space. Is less strong than the Brewer theorem because, you know, Banach is the guy who invented Banach spaces, and the Banach spaces are null spaces, so which are more than what we really need to assert this existence. But indeed, if the matrix space is complete, and if delta, if f is delta causal, then it has exactly one fixed point, and that fixed point can be found by starting with any signal tuple s and do this iteration. So you start with s1, which is equal to f of s0, s2 is equal to f of s1, and so on. Right. So this iteration is is again, if we keep on doing of exchanging the input with the output, then we end up having the fixed point that we look for. If a matrix space is compact, if it is, if V is a finite set and all signals are discrete events, then F only needs to be strictly causal instead of being delta causal, and then we can apply this Banach fixed point theorem. Now, notice that the Banach fixed point theorem is interesting because it gives you a procedure to compute the fixed point. Okay, so that's it's constructive, if you like, and which is this trivial iteration here. Now, in the case of continuous time or continuous functions, then fixed point iterations to find the solution are really bad. Right? I mean, they're horrible. So very, very slow. But they are the basic tool to demonstrate if you have a solution or not in a particular function. Again, the same goes away. Damnation. Okay. All right. So lesson. So if such systems are delta causal, then we know that we have a constructive way to find the unique behavior. Now, the some specification languages only insist on strict causality. Right? So VHDL is one such case. Again, the set of VHDL signals is not compact, and so the lack of a constructive solution to this problem explains why if you do VHDL simulation, you may end up with no advances in time. Right? So it keeps on iterating, trying to find the next step. It can find it. And essentially what you do is that you're going, what VHDL or any simulator, discrete simulator does, by the way, is not to pick on VHDL, you can pick on Verilog as well, same story. So it's this kind of simulator. What they do is that if you have a feedback loop like this, they break it at zero time, okay? It has to be zero time feedback loop, otherwise everything works. So then what they do is that they start from one point, and then they have to propagate the signal along this thing, right? Now, since they have no notion of scheduling all of these points together, so what they do is that they introduce this notion of delta time. So a delta time is a fictitious time, so as you march along the topology of the system, you add delta time. So here you are at time delta time 0, here you are at delta time 1, delta time 2, delta time 3, and then you come back here, and you keep on going. So at some point, if indeed you find the same value, right, when you come back here, then you can advance the real time, right, because delta has ended its iteration. And so when you see error messages like failure to advance in time, you know what it is. Okay? It's due to this thing. Now, in a similar fashion, if anyone has used, who has ever used Pi for solving? Okay, 1, 2, 3. Okay, so SPICE is a program that solves a differential equation that are related to circuits. Right? So essentially, it's a system, large system of ordinary differential equations. Now, the system of differential you too, right? Okay, no, no, you're done. So and the this ordinary. The system of ordinary equation actually is a mixed system. It's got algebraic equation as well together with differential equation. Now, sometimes the most horrible situation that happens all the time is that it says no convergence in DC, which means that you are trying to find what is the initial condition to go forward and to analyze the behavior of the system, and you get no convergence of the Newton-Raphson iteration. So, okay, fine, that's a disaster, and there are ways of coping with it. But sometimes you get failure of advanced time, of advancing time. Actually, what it says is really time step too small. So what is this time step too small? It's similar to this delta time. So what the solution, what the solver does is that it tries to take a time step here, right? Then it iterates, tries to find the solution, can find it in a certain number of iterations. So it says, uh-oh, something wrong. So what it does is that divide the time step by 2 and compute again. So instead of trying this step, tries half of the step. So uh-oh, I don't get within the prescribed number of iterations, divide by 2. Tick, 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 tick. Uh-oh, don't find the solution. Okay, so you reduce again the time step. And you keep on reducing, dividing by 2, dividing by 2, dividing by 2, dividing by 2, which essentially says that there is something very horrible that goes on between where you are and where you want to be. And so that very horrible thing can be a discontinuity, for example. Okay? And so the time step keeps on getting reduced. Because if it were continuous, then we know for sure that there is going to be a finite step in which we can obtain convergence of the nonlinear iteration. Okay? So, same phenomenon. And so what happens is that the function here, when I told you there is a discontinuity, that is non-causal. Right? Because if it were, we would have found the solution. Right? So, same thing. So no matter if you are in continuous and discrete, this fact of zero time or non-discontinuity of some sort kill you. So ordered signal process network. So these are particular set of processes. And so let T denote the tags in signal S. And let B T of S the union of the tags in the signals in the tuple S. So you take the tags of everything, right? In a two-sided ordered signal process network, TS is order isomorphic z, so the integer, for each thing not s. But the set of all tags ts is typically partially ordered. Now, this is kind of interesting. What it says is that you take a signal, a single signal, and then you have kind of an ordering of the text, right? So you have that you can put any event in the signal itself, and you can say where it is with respect to any other signal, right? So that's the meaning of what it says there. But if you say, so we have two signals, so for example, me and him, right? So we took this. So his events are all ordered, my events are all ordered, but the relation between our two events are only partially ordered, which means that I have to do one, two steps before I get to him, right? So this says that his event is two away from me, but that's about it, right? It doesn't say more. So it doesn't say if I do 22 steps, one step, whatever, right? It's simply relating two subsets of the signal, two subsets of the events in the signal. Now, why is this important? Because we will see that this is the situation, for example, when we have asynchronous signals, that's what's going on in there. And we'll see how we can use this kind of notion of ordered signal processing networks to go from synchronous system to asynchronous system that has the same property as the synchronous system. Okay? Same behavior as the asynchronous system. In a one-sided ordered signal process network, yes, is ordered isomorphic n, the natural number for each signal s. We it's the same thing that we've seen before when we were talking about two-sided signals and one-sided signals. It's essentially, if you look from minus infinity to plus infinity, from zero to plus infinity. Now, for any two distinct signals, S1 and S2, it could be very well be true that the intersection of the tag system is empty. So there is no relation whatsoever between the tag systems. Now, the events are in general called tokens, and a signal then is a sequence of tokens with no notion of time, again. So remember, we have tags, right? So in this ordered signal process network, we don't need to refer to time. It's just simply this partial order. An example of this kind of network is the one which we show there, which is essentially, if you really look at it, is a data flow network. But in any case, so what can we conclude in this process here? So because the tokens in each signal are ordered, we can say that EKI is less than EKJ for K for 1 and 2, right? So for each of the two signals, we can say what is the relative order of the two events. So suppose that each token consumed on the input results in exactly one token produced in the output, then we know that if this process is causal, then we know that EIJ is less, strictly less than E2J. Okay? Which means that in fact signals, the events in the signal S2 are caused by the events in signal S1. So a data flow process or actor is this kind of OSP, but it has a particular signal, which is a firing signal. And the firing signal is when you decide that the actor consumes input and produces output. Right? So that's the firing signal. And remember that in a data flow graph, we can give particular firing signals according to a scheduling preference, right? So we may have a number of nodes which are ready to go, in the sense that all the inputs are ready, but until there is a firing signal, you don't compute. Right? The firing signal is a sort of semaphore to let the process go or not. So a firing signal is both an input and an output, indeed, and contains all events that are comparable with all events in other input and output signals. And why is that? Because indeed, a firing always occurs between the input events and the output events, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be fired, right? So when the firing signal comes, the input goes to the output, right? And so we know that the firing is interspersed between input and output. And so a firing is an event in the firing signal, so it is a firing, and E prime is an event in any other input or output signal of the process. Then we know that E either precedes or follows E prime which again is this interspersing of input and output with the firing signal. So if we are given two successive firing, where event E1 is less than event E2, which means that the tags are ordered in this particular order, then an output event E prime, which is between E1 and E2, so is said to be produced by firing E1. Okay. So E1, then we have E prime, then we have E2. Okay, so in some sense, E prime is related to E1, is caused by E1. So an input event E prime, where E1 is less than E prime and less than E2, is said to be consumed by firing E2. Because in fact, we have firing, then we have E prime here, then E2 occurs, then it means that E prime is being fired by E2. So an example of data flow process, here is the situation here. So we have a two signal in input, S1 and S2. S3 is the firing signal, and S4 is the output. So the process consumes one token from each of S1 and S2 on each firing, and in this case produces only one token of S4. And the reason why is that is because we have these indices 1, 1, 1, which means one token, produce one token. So for each I, then we know that E1i, this guy here, is certainly less than E3i, which is the firing. E2i is less than E3i, because it's an input, so it has to be less than the firing. And we know that, of course, the output has to be following E3, so this relation must be true. So the text of this guy is larger than the text of this guy, because the firing takes the two tokens here and essentially produces the token at the output. So partially ordered signals. So how do we consider this particular situation? So we want to define the ordering between two signals, S1 and S2. So you got two signals, S1 and S2, and you want to be able to say if one is contains the other or not. So one obvious way of defining this inclusion is say that if every event in S1 is also an event in S2, right? So which means that S2 has more events than S1. So in this particular case, then it's obvious that S1 is contained in S2, in the sense that you can find S1 by looking at the events in S2. You rediscover it inside that one. And so this is a natural. But you can have a situation like this. Right? So let's see. That one is the one which right. You can have S1. Which is E1, E11, E12, E13. And then S2, which is E1, 1. Then there is E2, 2. Then there is E12. And then there is E13. Okay? So this includes is larger than that, because it has exactly the same events as this guy, plus one. But notice that this one event is in the middle. Right? So, if we want to instead to have a the notion that one signal is longer than another signal, in other words, has more events but at the tail, then we have to introduce this this prefix ordering stuff. In which case, then, these two signals are not related at all. Well, these two are.
E4.
Now these two, according to the prefix ordering, are related in such a way that S2 is bigger than S1, which means that S1 is containing S2 in the sense that the same sequence of events are in both signals, and S2 contains more events, but only at the end of it. Now, how is this important for anything? So suppose that you have a data flow network, right? So this one can be the signal S1 that you get by firing three times the actor, and this is the signals that you get after firing four times. Okay? So this you have only three events, this you got four events, right? Because you fire one more. So the set of tuples of ordered signal S to the power n, again, is a complete partial order, CPO, under the prefix order, which is a chain in S, pick a chain, pick a signal. And let's call a chain the following sequence of signals. So C is S1, S2, and so on, where each of these S is a relation to the previous one with that containment relation, so with the prefix order. Okay, so a chain is essentially, imagine to have an actor. The chain is the set of outputs that this actor generates, right, after every firing. Okay, so if you have an infinite firing, you get an infinite number of signals, and every time you fire, you have one more, and so the output of the actor in a data flow has this property, right? It's a chain. Now, every chain in a CPO in this complete partial order has a least upper bound, which is written with that funny symbol C, which means that I can have a very large signal in there, which contains all the sequence in the chain. Now, if you have an infinite sequence, and you keep on having S1 and so on and so forth, S2, S3, S4, S5, S6, and so on, and the sequence keeps on adding elements, then this does not have a least upper bound. So, given a set C of n tuples of signals, and a function that maps one set of signal into the other. So the notion f of c denotes the set of n tuples of signals that results from applying the function f to each element of the chain. And so this one is a shorthand notation to say that I take all the elements of this chain and apply f to s1, s2, s3, s4, s5, s6, and so on. Now, why should I want to do that? Well, the problem that I want to, quote unquote, attack and solve is to see what is the behavior in time of a particular network and see if it is producing results that make sense. Now, remember that we introduced CAN process networks several days ago. And in this particular framework of attack signal model, a CAN process is an OSC that is also a continuous function. So what does it mean, a continuous function? So remember that a continuity in continuous time, in continuous functions, says that if you take a sequence of x's such that x goes to x0, and you take a sequence of the corresponding f of x, right? So f of x1, x2, until for each element of x goes to there. Then the function is continuous if, when you are close enough to x0, the function is also, the function f of x is close to f of x0. Okay? And there is a relationship between the delta, which is the distance in the x space, and the epsilon, which is the distance in the functional space. So in particular, it says that given any epsilon, there exists a delta in the input space x, such that if x minus x0 is less or equal than delta, then f of x minus f of x0 is less or equal than epsilon. Okay? So that's the notion of continuity. Now, this implies that we have a notion of things that, that convert to something, and we have a notion of sequences of points, and we have a notion of matrix, and so on and so forth. Now, in discrete space, the thing is not so obvious, because we don't have this notion of things kind of getting closer and closer and closer and closer. So what actually the mathematicians who have studied discrete systems have called continuity is little to do with what we imagine to be continuity, but it is used to assess some of the properties of the system. So the definition of continuity in the discrete sense, it says that takes the least upper bound of C, then apply F to the least upper bound of C, what you get is the least upper bound of the sequence F of C. Okay, so you can interchange F and this notation of least upper bound. Okay? So we have some notion of kind of formal notion is similar to what we have just said for the continuity in the functional space. So this is called also topological continuity in the Scott topology. Scott is a well-known mathematician who dealt with discrete functions. Now, the interesting point is that there is a fixed-point theorem which is based on this kind of notion, and shows that networks of continuous processes in a complete partial order have a unique least fixed point, which we take to be the semantic of the feedback loop. Right? And so the reason why we have done all of this formalization is to get to this system. It's to give a condition when you have a least fixed point on the iteration when you have a feedback connection. And again, you have actors that fire continuously the signals, and the signals in the end convert. Okay, we'll look later how that goes. But there is another notion that is of interest in improving this result, which is the notion of monotonicity. Now, we know that in the case of a continuous function, a monotone function, says that if you have x which is larger than x prime, then f of x is larger than f of x prime. Right? That's monotonic increasing. Is the opposite, so f of x prime is less than f of x, is monotonically decreasing. And this is for any x in the interval that we are interested in. So that's the notion of monotony. So, well, now if you take the less relation that we have in the continuous space to be the prefix order, as we see there, then this translates by saying that F3 being contained in F1 implies that F of F3 is contained in F of F1. Right? Very similar to the notion of formally is very similar to the notion of monotonicity that we have in continuous space. Now notice that what the theorem says is that if I have any continuous process, then F must be monotonic. So F continuous implies monotonic. Is that the case in the continuous case, or not? Of course not. Right? You have a continuous function that like this, right? And so they are certainly not monotonically increasing, not monotonically decreasing. But in this case, it's funny because continuity implies monotonicity. And the proof is there, which is kind of a very funny proof, very trivial if you like. So assume that F is continuous, and now consider two signals where S1 is less or equal than S2. Now, define the increasing chain, which is S1, S2, 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 forever. Right? So this is increasing, all right, chain. Then what is the least upper bound of this, since it's all S2s here, is S2. And because S2 is larger than S1. So for continuity, we have that F of S2 is equal to f of the least upper bound of c, which since is continuous, also the least upper bound of f of c, which then is the least upper bound between f of s1 and f of s2. So it means that f of s1 must be less or equal than f of s2, has to be contained in f of s2, and so the process is monotonic. And why is that? Of course, if I have f of s2, which is the least upper bound of these two, it's obvious that it must be less than this guy. Right? And so that this very trivial proof, but it says something interesting with respect to the continuous case. So suppose that f of s, of course we will show that monotonicity does imply continuity. In the continuous case it is, right? So it's all reverse, right? In the continuous case it's the opposite of what is true in the discrete case. So assume that f of s is zero if s is finite and is the pair 0, 1 otherwise. So we want to show that this is monotone. So note that if s is infinite, and s is less or equal than s prime, then s must be equal to s prime. So f of s, of course, is contained in f of s prime. If s is finite, then what we have is f of s is always equal to 0, which is a prefix of all possible outputs. And so this is indeed a monotone function. Now, how come it's not continuous? So consider this chain, any chain, S0 containing S1 containing blah, 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 where each SI has exactly I events in it. So this one has 0 events, this has 1, the next one has 2, and the next one is 3, and so on. So every time we increase I, we increase the number of events. So the list of upper bound of C is infinite because this guy keeps on growing, right? So there is no list upper bound. It's infinite. So now, if I take the least upper the function computed the least upper bound, since the least upper bound is infinite, then f of s is 0, 1, which is different than the least upper bound of f of C that was 0. So there you go. So this one is a monotonic process that is non-continuous. Okay, so same question occurs. Remember that in general, the kind of one very nice property of any system that we look at is composability, right? Can we compose? And what does that mean, that can we compose? But if I have two subsystems that have a particular property, if you compose them, you want the composition to have the same property, and it's composability. Which means that if we know that this guy, I don't know, is monotonic, this guy is monotonic, we combine the two, we would like to have the process monotonic, right? So we don't have to check. Now, monotonic may be interesting or not, that's a different issue. That what we will want to be able to is to infer the property of an ensemble given the fact, given the properties of the pieces, right? Now, is in general embedded system design satisfy that property? Do people use composable techniques? The answer is a resounding no. Do they want to have techniques and methodologies so that things are composable? The answer is a resounding yes. Okay, so there is a nice dichotomy between what people do and what they would like to do. Okay. And the reason is that the conditions under which you can compose things are pretty tricky to assess, right? So it's not always trivial to do. Now, in this particular case, these are abstract notions, so we show how you can assess the general properties. And we know that the deal breaker is the feedback loop composition. Everything which is parallel, everything which is cascade is no problem. The feedback always gives us a problem. So in this case, same story. So the composition, if you have a parallel composition of two continuous processes, then the composition is functional, which means given a set of inputs, you get only a set of outputs, and continuous or monotonic if the components are functional and continuous or monotonic. So the property transfer straight through, and is obvious because there is no interaction between the two. Now the cascade composition is a very controlled interaction here. And so the composition here is functional and continuous or monotonic if the components are functional and continuous or monotonic. And this is obvious because again, this property of the fact that this input is a subset of all the possible inputs that this guy can see, and so for sure the property is maintained. Source composition, same story. So if F1 is determinate, then an F2 has the property that we are interested in. The composition of the two has the properties of F2. Aha! Now the feedback composition is the, as usual, the tricky part. And so we open again the loop and we try to determine what is the solution of this, I mean, what comes out of this. And so if F1 and F3 are determinate, so because they now become source processes, and F2 is continuous or monotonic, then the function F will be continuous or monotonic respectively. So, which is nice, but we need to have these properties for F1 and F3. They must be determinate. And F2, which is the guy which is which contains the feedback loop there, must be continuous or monotonic. And then we know that the composition has that property as well. So now, feedback composition, now we define f of Sn into Sn, is a semantic to be the least fixed point of f, which is the smallest f in a prefix order sense, such that f of s is equal to f. In other words, what we do is that we keep on going around the loop and generating signals, right? At some point, these signals, if indeed it will, the sequence of signals, if indeed it will converge, stays the same, right? And so, which means that the chain is going to replicate all these s. So, the least upper bound is that. And so that is the fixed point. Okay. So the least fixed point theorem, say, when can we say that such a thing is? So we say that the desired behavior here is the smallest one, consistent with the specification. And the first point theorem 1 says that the continuous function f is at least a fixed point, which is the least upper bound of the sequence. You put in the set of empty signals, you get S1. Then you put S1 in here, you apply F to S1, you get S2. Then you apply F to S2, you get S3, and so on. Now, because of the continuity, we can determine that indeed the fixed point must exist, otherwise the function will not be continuous. Now, this you may want to prove yourself based on the definition of continuity. It's pretty straightforward, but it's a very nice result, if you like. The fixed point theorem 2 says that a monotonic function has at least a fixed point. Notice that in the case of a monotonic function is an existence result, but doesn't give you the procedure to compute that fixed point. Then again, given an input constraint, or given a set of inputs, the least fixed point is a unique value, which is the minimum of the intersection between the behavior of the process and I under the prefix order. So in this case, we include the inputs, the external inputs that come into the system. In this case, here, we didn't specify that we had an input, so was any process that was just connected to itself and was endogenous, meaning that there was no exogenous variable. Now, let's talk about sequential processes at rendezvous. So what are the a rendezvous process? A rendezvous process is you got two processes and they go along on their own speed, on their own sequence of events and so on. We say that there is a rendezvous at a particular point if a particular event is the same in both signals, which means that they have to synchronize only at specific points, and in between they can do whatever. Right? So this is a rendezvous. So in S3, which is a connection between P1 and P2, then this S3, which is establishing the connection between P1 and P2, has to have a signal in S1 and a signal in S2 that have the same tag as S3, which means that they have to agree at that particular tag. And this is called the rendezvous. It's when you exchange information, right? So you have to exchange information at that particular tag. Now, we have done PetriNet. So PetriNets have a representation of this tag signal model and with this notion of processes and the like. And so the PetriNet, we know that there are different combinations of places and transitions. So this one is a serial connection of a place and a transition. So A, there exists a one-to-one function from S2 to S1 such that F of E is less than E for all E in S2, which simply means that whatever comes out of S2 has to come out of S1. Now, when you have that situation where you have two places and a transition connected like that, it says that there exists two one-to-one functions that map S3 into S1 and S3 into S2, such that the events in S1 and S2 are less than events E in S3, which again says that the two places receive events from the transition S3. Now, what happens in the opposite situation, where S1 comes before S2 and S3, S2 and S3 converge into S1. In this particular case, it says that there exist two one-to-one functions, F1 which goes from S2 to S1, and F2 which is S3 to S1, such that F1 of E is less than E for all E in S2, in S2, and F2 of E less than E for all E S3, with the understanding that the function F1 S2 intersected with S2 S3 is zero, right? Is empty, is the empty set, which means that either one or the other is enabled, but not both, as we know. That's the famous choice, right, that we have seen in PetriNet. So this one are the three possible composition of places and transitions. So this set of ABC of rules will give you the rule to describe the behavior of the entire PetriNet. Now, what happens in a situation like, for example, the cascade of two processes like this and the feedback loop with a place and a transition? And this is the definition of what the signal, how you generate the signal. The previous one were conditions on the sequencing of the events in the signal. Now we say that if this one is the token I, then we say that S2 is equal to S1 union with I. And the situation described in the function in the second picture in E, it says that F2 is a function from S2 to S1 union with I1. And then you have function S3 that is a mapping from S3 to S2, and the S3 then is obtained by the union of S2 and I2. Now in this particular case we know that F2 of E is less than E and F3 of E is less than E, so that F3 of F2 of E is less than E. Okay? So which is essentially describing the cascade of these two places and the relative transition. Now, in this particular case, when you have this feedback loop between S1 and S2, then it simply says that the set S2 in this configuration can only be the empty set. So there are lots of related models to what we have seen of the text signal model. So these are a list of things that people have used to describe signals and to prove properties about signals. But indeed, the model that is probably closer is this model by Yates, in which as delta causal function processes in a time model with matrix time. So if you look at all these papers, they all relate to time stamps of time or notion of time. A very much touted model is the Lamport model, 1978, which is a very nice description, very simple and very powerful. and essentially gives a mechanism which messages in an asynchronous system carry timestamps, and the process is manipulated with timestamps. And that's what, you know, is also what we have seen here. Now notice that all of these guys always talk about timestamps. There is no one who's talking about text in a generic sense. So with the trick of the text, we can express a lot of information about the ordering of events that the other people were not doing. So, we call it the beginning of a framework, but actually it is a framework for understanding of comparing models of computation. And again, there are a set of mathematical techniques that you can use to analyze the properties. And again, the idea here was to use a framework to understand heterogeneous mixture, and indeed it was used that way. And so I'm going to show you in one particular case how you can do that, and that is what I promised you, the desynchronization. How the heck do I close that? Okay. This doesn't bode well. Okay, come on. Okay, here it goes. Why is it taking so long? Okay, there we go. Okay, so this is the issue of heterogeneous reactive models correct by construction deployment. So what does that mean? So you got a model of computation, yes, and you want to map this model of computation into a particular architecture. It is a different model of computation. Now the question is that how do you make sure that when you put this into that, the properties that you had before are maintained? And so what is the basic properties that we look at? Well, if you put a guy, right, so you have a tent which is closed, right? That's what the guy is here. Now you put the original system not mapped into a different model of computation and this other thing, and they spit out stuff, right? And you look at the stuff that comes out. Now we say that the two are indistinguishable if the sequence of things that come out of the tent are the same. Notice that I say the sequence of things. You don't say the sequence exactly the, let's say, the time in which the things come out. I say the sequence. So if this guy does 1, 2, 6, 7, this guy must do 1, 2, 6, 7. But this guy may do 1, 2, 6, 7 very fast, and this guy is 1, 2, 6, 7. They are equivalent under the notion of behavior equivalence. And so this is also called stream equivalence. So we have the same stream of events in the two things, in the two particular blocks. Now, and again, this one is very important when you say, well, I want to have the given same input, I want to get the same output when I start with a model of computation which is nice like synchronous, and I have a model of computation which is not nice like an asynchronous model. So this one was a work that we started with the French guys who invented synchronous synchronous model. So Albert Benveniste and Paul Castille, these are two of the key guys that define Lustre. They participated to the definition of Signal, and it was one of the two most important synchronous model of computation. So that came up by saying, again, asking the question, can we use this model that I just presented you to show the stream equivalence of a synchronous thing when once it is mapped into an asynchronous architecture. So this kind of Oh, quite interesting, I believe. Okay, so let's see how it goes. Okay. So now a reminder of what synchronous models are. So it's a synchronous process evolves according to an infinite sequence of successive reactions, and the parallel composition of two processes is a conjunction of their reactions. And so this is equivalent to the product of automata, SSM connection, and so on. And so if we use the text signal model, it says that every signal is synchronous with every other signal in the process, right? So that's what synchronicity means. Okay, so synchronous model is foundation of synchronous languages. Again, SRL Lusser signal, as we say, is pervasive, we know that, and when composition is possible, we can reason formally on the properties. And how do we reason formally on the properties? Because we can look at the topology of the finite state machine and infer some results, but we can also analyze what is a reachable set of states, for example, to say if the system, for example, reaches any particular bad state that we don't want to reach, then we can say that the system that we have is not satisfying the specification because it goes into a bad state, right? So that is, these are in general called safety properties and are very much used in embedded applications like automotive and avionics. So it's very nice, okay? Now, the communication, in general, a synchronous assumption says the communication delay is negligible with respect to computation delay. I wouldn't say this. This one is what is written in the paper. But what it really means is that the computation and the communication are separate phases, and that how long it takes to compute or to communicate does not matter because they are not overlapping. So we don't even know the time that it takes to compute the function or to communicate, because remember that when we have a synchronous system and these kind of things, the real interpretation is the fact that we have things that line up, but there is no notion of distance, no metric on the text in there. We just have an ordering of the text, but no notion of the difference, quote unquote, between texts. And so, in fact, they also talk about zero time. So zero time computation, zero time communication. But again, that is a misnomer. Again, I repeat. And so, we had many discussions with my French friends. The correct description is that it doesn't matter how much time it takes because it's not modeled. The only thing that we model is the reaction, right? And the sequence of the reaction. So now, distributed nature of implementation. We know that when we have large systems, so either this large system are large circuit or are large networks of subsystems, think about an airplane, for example, or an automobile. So in hardware, what happens is that with the chips become a distributed system because they are so large with respect to the size of the component that the wire delays are non-negligible with respect to the transistor delay. And again, on-chip communication latency, so the time that it takes to go from one place to the other, is very hard to estimate. Now, if we look in software, the application with distributed nature badly match the synchronous assumption. Why is that? Because there is a significant delay in communication, and this significant delay, if you insist in having a synchronous implementation, it will take way too long to compute, and so people will be very upset about that and will not, in fact, they do not use this model. So in fact, all this analysis was originated by the work done at Airbus when they tried to use synchronous model, but then the Airbus was so large, then the wires were so long that you had lots of delays, and so they would say, oh my god, how am I going to make sure that I have a synchronous system, and I don't waste a lot of time trying to ensure that. Plus, I don't know if everybody has the same clock, right? So I don't even know if the two guys are having this information about time, which is correct to this point. Hard to maintain a global notion of time. Okay, so this one is actually what happens in a very large scale system. So you can see that there are these thin parts of the chip can be reached in 16 clock cycles versus the internal of the chip, which takes just one clock cycle. And so the distribution is all over the place. And the smaller the chip becomes, the more you have the distribution which is towards the large side, so the long delay. So, I mean, if you are willing to wait 16 clock cycles to compute, it's going to be the chips implemented with 32 nanometers are going to go slower than the previous one, which is not a good thing to have. So again, you can reach only 5% of the die's length in a clock cycle, and so the cause is a combination of high frequencies and slower wires. So what do we do in there? So electronics in the car, we already saw this, it's a very complicated, messy network here, and you got more than 80 microprocessors and millions of lines of code, and so these delays are really not forgiving and cannot be eliminated. So again, the tag signal model we know is a common formal framework for models of computation, and we can use it for synchronous, asynchronous, and Gauss. What is Gauss? Actually, there are entire conferences dedicated to Gauss. Anyone knows what Gauss stands for? Yes? Yes, that's it. And so what that says is that you have islands of synchronous behavior, but since you are so far and take so long to go from here to there, that you would like to use asynchronous models for the communication across the chip or across the network, right? So this is actually would be fantastic to have. So that's the reason why there are entire conferences dedicated to Gauss, right? Okay. We're all running around always the same question, the same kind of set of techniques that people are using. Indeed, we are interested in the desynchronization problem because we know that we have a synchronous model, now we got these horrendous platforms that are asynchronous in nature. Can we then desynchronize our synchronous model and work with asynchronous implementation of it? So let's say $1 million question. So Gauss would be a particular case, right? So we go from a formal model which is synchronous, fully synchronous, and now we map into a much freer model which is very interesting because that's the way in which implementation runs. Okay, let's see how that goes. So again, just a reminder what an event is a cross product of values and tags. A signal set of events. A process is a subset C. A behavior is a tuple of signals, and a system is a composition of processes. Right? So one slide is a summary of what we have defined and done in the past 1.5 lecture. Now again, tags can be a mechanism to express time. We know that across various levels of abstraction, so you can have logical time in initial specification and physical real time in final implementation. Right? So in synchronous reactive models, then a tag will indicate the index of the reaction. So reaction 1, reaction 2, reaction 3 with no notion of time. When we implement and we implement in synchronous, then reaction 1 is time T0, reaction 2 is time 5 nanoseconds, 3 is 10 nanoseconds, 15 nanoseconds, 15 nanoseconds, and so on, okay? So you see the difference there. Now, think about this. Suppose that I go from this reaction model into a time model in which indeed the reaction index has a meaning in a globally ordered sense. Now, in some sense, what we have done is that we have refine the original model, because the original model before, we said that nothing, it didn't matter how long it was between one reaction and the next reaction. Now, in here, it depends on the clock cycle. So suppose that You have a clock cycle very fast. Maybe even nothing happens. And between 22 clock cycles, nothing happens. And the 23rd, something happens, you can feel, right? So what happened is that we introduce a lot of nothing in between, right? So if we have the behavior of a system with all this clock cycle in time and so on, well, what we have done is that we have eliminated degree of freedom from the system as any refinement, right? Now, suppose that I want to change that implementation, and I have a variety of different implementations by changing the clock cycle, by going globally asynchronous, locally synchronous, and so on. Now, why can't I, in the text, include also the information that I have lost? Right? So it's sort of information placeholder. And so I can add, for example, in my text, two entities. One is the logical index, and the other one is the time in the implementation. So not only I have the implementation, but I have the somewhat redundant information that was before I did the refining. Right? That is a tax. Tax is not necessarily just one entity. It can be a set. Right? So it can be a set of fields, different fields that tell me different things. So this is also to give you an idea on how you can use the text. And indeed, we will see that in some of these approaches to desynchronization, we use that composite text to remember where the reaction was coming from, because that was a thing that I care about, while the actual clock cycle and all that, I don't really care about. Okay, so I want to maintain both information around, and so I can use the tag as a concept for that. So again, tags are essentially a tool to express constraints, and in particular coordination constraints. And so we see that some processes are actually operating just on tags and don't do anything to the signal. So for example, communication processes, in the way in which we model things, are acting only on text, but not on the value of event. Now, we also expressed a great deal of attention to the notion of absent value event. So we say that the signal S is present tag T when there exists an event which has that tag and a particular value D. Now, notice that if D is nothing there, which is a bottom signal, we can say that S is absent at tag T, is present when the value D is different from the absent value. The absent value. So in this particular case, we have U, which is 4 minus 2, 5, nothing here, minus 1, 3, 0, etc., etc. You notice that this one is a tag. There is a value here, so this event is present, not present, and so on. Okay? And so this is again is needed, because remember that in the reaction model, the synchronous assumption says that whenever I see something that changes, I have to look at it. But I have to look at every signal in the system, because I have to place an event at that particular set on all the things. Okay, so that's the reason why we use this absent value. It's essential. It's not something that we may get by with. And so the assumption of the tags of a signal for any tag T in T, each signal S in the system, has at most one event. And this implies that it's and then this property here is that if E1 belongs to S and E2 belongs to S, then you cannot have the same tag for these two events of the same signal. So you don't have multiple events for the same tag, which is a functional process. Remember? So we remember that we define a functional process when there was a function between the set of tags and the value of the system. So so this implies a total order among the tags of the signal and a total order among the events of the signal. So which means that this assumption that we are making now belong to the ordered process network that we have seen in the theory far before, which is very natural. So we, when you look at the signal, it's natural to think that the events in the signal are ordered in a particular way. So this is the notion. And then the relationship between two signals can be nothing. So it can be no relation between each other. But in a single signal, then having only partial order between it is unnatural, right? It's not that it's impossible, because formally and mathematically we can do that, but we assume instead that there is an ordering that is the notion, as we said before, of the ordered signal model. Okay, so on Thursday we'll keep on going. Ciao. Devo stoppare.